This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
For those of you who were in shul last night and today, I'm going to work the idea that I developed in the drosha last evening on Friday night. So I will start off by repeating part of Friday night's drosha. I'm then going to link it to the medrash that I quoted this morning at the Kiddush, and then use the projected concept to answer one of the kashas that the Balei Musar ask on this week's sedra. So for those of you who weren't in shul, that's just an ordinary Motzei Shabbos shiur. For those of you who were, what you should note is the development of the theme to utilize and to project it further to deal with other issues. The drosha last night revolved around the practicalities of the midah of anova, the characteristic of modesty, which is considered as one of the fundamental characteristics that a ben Torah has to develop. And we're at a disadvantage in that modesty is a concept or a characteristic which is also stressed heavily in the New Testament, Lahavdil, and it's surprising how much of an influence Western Christian thinking is, even on from people. And we need to define what really Torah or modesty is. What is anova? What are the gedorim? What are the limitations? How far does it go? It's one of the only two midos which the Rambam says in Hilchos Deos one has to move to the extreme in. All other characteristics one has to try and develop some kind of a balance. But when it comes to gaiva, when it comes to arrogance, or its opposite, humility, the Rambam says there's no middle path in that. One has to develop anything that's not extreme is not acceptable. One has to move right away from the one side, right away even from the center, and one has to move right over to the ultimates of modesty. And what we're dealing with is the fear that the ultimates of modesty annihilate personality. That's really what we've got to deal with. But as a person becomes, we then want people to become humble, like Uriah Heep in which one was the Great Expectations? Sorry, David Copperfield was Uriah Heep. Sorry. And how does one avoid that? How does one avoid producing this very, very humble image who's lost personality, who's lost stature, who's lost dynamicism, because he's humble? And you ask him for his opinion on something and he says, who am I to give an opinion? And you ask him, how are you feeling today? He says, what does it matter how I'm feeling? The main thing is that Ribono Shel Olam is around, that's all that's important. And you ask him, whatever you ask him, can you help me? I'm having a bit of a difficulty with this piece of Chumash and with this piece of Rashi. Can you help me? Me help you? What do I know more than you know? I'm useless. I'm no good. I'm nobody. And one can find a total annihilation of personality. And yes, he's modest. Isn't that nice? Isn't that fine? We know that that's not normal. So what we're really trying to find is modesty to the extreme in a normal personality. That's the difficulty. We need to be concerned a little bit that modern frumkeit, not only in modern frumkeit, it's in many, many areas, both Jewish and non-Jewish areas, the tendency is to use progress in frumkeit as an excuse for retrogression in normality. And to say it doesn't matter that he's meshuggah a little bit, he's becoming about sugar, that's why. It's not good enough. We can't really accept that people's personality development should be impaired because they're becoming frum. Should be fakir, the opposite. As people become more and more involved in Torah, you should see stature developing, you should see people becoming bigger and greater, and personality growing, and character strengthening, and stature becoming much more mighty. Not a diminishment of stature, not a diminishment of personality. And regrettably, one doesn't see that all that often. One does see it. And it's very gratifying when one does see it, but one doesn't see it all that often. And humility, the midah of anova, is one of those midahs which, if not pursued correctly, has within its power to totally destroy the human personality, and that would be tragic. And so what we discussed last night very briefly was, what is that midah of anova? How does one develop the characteristic of modesty within the context of normal personality development? And our starting point is to say, let's try and find a character who is normal. Let's try and find a character who has enormous stature, who does not suffer from the normal inhibitions of the humble person, a person who shows himself to be confident and to be dominant and to be able to lead and to be able to do all the things that an effective personality has to do, and yet is modest as well. And we're fortunate enough to find that one of the most outstanding, not one of the most, the most outstanding personality in the Torah happens also to be the most outstanding person when it comes to the area of Anova. So not only is it not necessary for modesty to annihilate personality, but we find through the analysis of the character of Moshe Rabbeinu, referred to by Hashem himself as the most modest person that ever lived in the world, and we see also a person with the most sophisticated and developed character and personality that ever existed in the world, we see that synthesized into one human being, the ultimate of humility and the ultimate of greatness in one human being, and therefore we must come to the conclusion that not only is there no need for humility to annihilate personality, but on the contrary, humility should build personality, humility should construct personality. And so we need to analyze the character and the characteristics of Moshe Rabbeinu to understand how those two elements can be synthesized. Greatness of personality and character together with extremism in humility, which the Rambam says is the only measure of humility that is truly acceptable. And the Chazal that we focused on from this week's Sedra was the Rashi. In Perek Yud Pasuk Gimel, where the Rashi says, after the two sons of Aaron are killed in the service of the Bishkan, the Moshe Rabbeinu says, "Hu Asher Diber Hashem Lemor." This is what Hashem said, saying, "Bikrovai Ekodesh." I shall become sanctified through people who are very close to me. Va'al Pnei Chol Ha'om Ekoved, and that way I will be honored in front of all the people. And it explains Rashi in the name of the Torah's Kohenim and the Medrash. Al tikri bichavoidai ela b'mechubada. Omar Moshe la'Aaron. Moshe said to Aaron, Aaron achi, Aaron my brother, yodea hu yisi shis kadesh habayis b'meyudov shel mokim. I knew, Hashem told me, that the introduction of the temple service in the Mishkan was going to take place through the sanctification of Hashem's name by people who are closest to Him, by somebody who is closest to Hashem, the Meyudah of somebody who is a close acquaintance of the Ribbono Shel Olam. And in trying to figure out who this would be, who is it that is so close to the Ribbono Shel Olam that he would be successful in being the one to sanctify Hashem's name, I thought this should either be you or me, either you, Aaron, or it would be me, myself. Now I see that your sons, my nephews, are greater both than you and me. That's how he comforted Aaron. The comforting of Aaron is very nice, but the original assumption, where Moshe says quite unashamedly, I knew it would be you or me. How did I know? Because Hashem said it would be one of my acquaintances. And who is there that is an acquaintance of the Ribbono Shel Olam other than you or me? It's one of the two of us. Where do we see the modesty of Aish Moshe Omer of Michol Odom? Where do we see here an expression of Moshe being more modest than any human being? So here we see an example of Moshe's self-confidence. Here we see an example of Moshe's personality, of his self-esteem, the ultimate in self-esteem. And what's important to see here is that self-esteem and modesty do not contradict one another. And we shall show further on, not only do self-esteem and modesty not contradict one another, but self-esteem is impossible without modesty, without the true understanding of modesty. Here we see Moshe as the ultimate in self-esteem. Hashem says the Mishkan is going to be sanctified by one of his acquaintances. Who can it be? It's me or you, Aaron. One of the two of us can't be anybody else. That's the ultimate of self-esteem. I know my value. And yet when it comes to modesty, Moshe is referred to as the most modest of all people. And we explain that with Reb Leib Chassman's analysis or explanation of the Gemara that says, Ein ha-toiro miskayemes, the Gemara in Sota Daf Chafalef Amud Beis, Ein toiro miskayemes el b'mi she meisim atzmei k'mi she enoi. Torah only survives in a person who makes himself as if he doesn't exist. So here we see a definition of modesty. A person who makes himself as if he doesn't exist. And I pointed out that it doesn't say in the Gemara, Torah only exists in a person who makes it as if the Torah doesn't exist in him. That's not what it says. So if you have a person who's a very great Talmid Chacham, and you go up to him and you say, you know, you're an exceptionally great Talmid Chacham, he doesn't have to say, no, I'm not. I'm not such a great Talmid Chacham. It's mishemesim atzmo kemishem eino. It's the personality, the ego, which is diminished, not the value of the achievement. And that's what's important to understand when we're talking about our own achievements or our own talents. There are two parts. There's the part which is me, the individual, and there is the part which is my achievements, or which is my talents. So you may, for example, hear a great pianist play a piece of music, and you can go out to the pianist afterwards and say, that was unbelievable, that piece that you played was absolutely exceptional, what a talent you've got, what a gift you've got. And the one option, if he's going to respond modestly, if he's going to respond arrogantly, then he just says, thank you very much, yes, I am the greatest pianist in the world and I'm pleased you acknowledge it. We'll stop. That's if he's going to be arrogant. If he's going to be modest in a Christian sense, he says, no, you only think I'm a great pianist because you don't have any taste and any culture and you haven't heard the great ones. That's what he does if he's modest in a Christian sense. But if he's modest in the Torah sense, what he'll say is, I'm pleased, I feel honored that you mentioned that, and I feel gratified. I'm very fortunate that God gave me this gift. That's all. And that way he's acknowledging the achievement, he's acknowledging the talent without in any way denigrating from it, and yet without inflating his own ego. On the contrary, it's Kamisha Mesim Atzmi Kamisha Eino. I have no part in that talent. This is a gift from the Ribbono Shel Olam. And as a gift from the Ribbono Shel Olam, I can acknowledge it freely without feeling that I am impinging on modesty in any kind of a sense. That's the beauty of it. If I see my talents as a gift from the Ribbono Shel Olam, I can feel free to acknowledge them. I don't have to feel restricted. If I feel they're my own, then I have to be careful how I acknowledge them, because any acknowledgement of my talents is going to be a bloating of my own ego. But if I accept that it's not my own, it's from the Ribbono Shel Olam, then it's different. And I gave you the example last night, which is very important, of the man who saves up for many years. His ambition is that for his 20th wedding anniversary, he's going to go to Bernie Scher here, and he's going to buy the most magnificent diamond necklace for his wife. Top quality diamonds, only the best, the right kind of size, and that's what he's going to do. And he starts saving up first day of his marriage. Every month he puts something away towards that. And every month he phones Bernie Scher up to ask how the price of diamonds are going, and he keeps track of it to see that he's with inflation and all that, he's going to manage, and he saves and he saves and he saves. And finally the day is coming and he's able to purchase the most magnificent diamond necklace. And he gives it to his wife and he takes her out one evening to a dinner, and somebody comes up to his wife and says, my goodness, what a beautiful diamond necklace you're wearing. Now what is she going to say? She wants to be modest. She says, ha, it's rubbish. There's nothing magnificent at all about it. And he's standing right there. And she just says, I'm just trying to be modest. I don't want the other person to feel that I'm boasting. What's wrong with that? It's a lack of understanding of what modesty is. And if she said, yes, it is a magnificent diamond necklace, I'm very rich, I'm able to buy these things, you understand? That's arrogant. So what is that middle line that we're talking about? The middle line is very simple. Yes, it is a very beautiful diamond necklace. Aren't I fortunate to have such a husband? That's all. So it's not mine. I'm not inflating my ego. I'm inflating my husband's ego. That's okay. You don't have to be modest for other people. That's an important thing to realize. We get it wrong sometimes. We think when we're praising other people, we have to be modest. We have to play it down a little bit. Why should we praise other people? When it comes to ourselves, we can be arrogant. But the truth is, the Baalei Musar tell us it's the other way around. The good midas we have to use on ourselves, and the bad midas we have to use on other people. We've got to be mean with ourselves, generous with other people. Most people do it for themselves, they know how to be generous. And for other people, they know how to be mean. When a fellow goes out to buy himself a hi-fi set, all he wants to do is make sure that he's got the latest technology, that it's the best, the price doesn't matter, just see that I've got the best. He wants a new motor car, he wants to know it's the latest model, and it must have metallic paint, and leather upholstery, and the finest radio inside, and a telephone as well. And when his wife goes to buy some dresses, and she comes back, and he says, you have to buy the most expensive in the whole shop, you couldn't find anything else a little cheaper? So with him, and she says, but after all, and he says, you know, and what about tzedakah? You've got to spend everything on dresses. You could have bought something a little bit cheaper and given something to tzedakah. Well, the tzaddik. It's for his wife. He knows how to watch out for tzedakah too. When it comes to himself, only the best. Should be fakir, the other way around. When it comes to you, instead of spending the 5,000 rand, spend 4,000 rand and give 1,000 to tzedakah. When it comes to your wife, spend the 5,000 rand. That's how it is. That's how it's meant to be. When it comes to modesty, be modest with yourself. You want to be arrogant, you want to blow your trumpet, blow somebody else's trumpet if you enjoy blowing trumpets so much. That's how it's meant to be. And so for the lady to say, yes, it is a beautiful diamond necklace, aren't I fortunate to have such a husband? She's blowing his trumpet. That's fine. That's not immodest. And then he's proud and she's proud and everybody's happy. There's nothing negative in such a transaction. And so it is, the Ribbono Shel Olam gives this pianist that we were talking about the most magnificent talent, and from an early childhood age that this person was playing the piano most magnificently and was written up by all the critics as the future star of the piano playing world. And after years of developing and practicing this talent, you come up to the pianist and Hashem is listening, and you say to the pianist, what a talent, what a gift. And the pianist says, ah, it's nothing, you haven't heard anything really good, nothing. What does Hashem feel like? I've given this pianist this gift and this talent, and he can't even acknowledge it. This is an opportunity for Kiddush Hashem, and he pushes it aside. He just pushes it aside. Why? In the name of modesty, in the name of Anova. That's not Anova. That's missing an opportunity for Kiddush Hashem. The pianist would say, "Yes, thank you very much. I'm pleased you acknowledge it. I am so fortunate that God has chosen me for this magnificent talent, and I hope I can live up to the Ribbono Shel Olam's expectations of me." That's the answer, which is not an answer of arrogance. And yet it's acknowledging the talent. There's no need to push it down and to diminish it and to pretend that it doesn't exist in any kind of a way. Torah only exists in a person who makes himself, his own ego, as if it doesn't exist. He doesn't diminish the value of his gifts. He doesn't diminish the value of his talents. He diminishes his own role in the achievement of those talents. Yes, they're there, but they're not mine. They're gifts of the Ribbono Shel Olam. You go to somebody and say, you're so fortunate to be so wealthy, to be so well off. So the one thing you can say, that's not well off, I'm not so well off, and I've also got debts, and it's not so much. Or the other is to say, you're right, I am very fortunate, but you should know that's a bracha from the Ribbono Shel Olam. There are many people who are cleverer than me and who work harder than me who don't have it. The Ribbono Shel Olam, for whatever reason, has given me this responsibility. I hope I can live up to it, and thank you for the compliment. And that leaves you acknowledging the compliment with in no way expanding your own ego. And you remember the famous Reb Chaim Shmuel Levitz that we've discussed so many times, where Paro asks Yaakov how old he is, and Yaakov goes into a long answer, I'm not as old as my father was, and I didn't reach the same old age as my father reached. And Chazal say that the number of letters in his answer were reduced from his age, from his destined age. And Reb Chaim Shmuel Levitz adds it up and he says, but it doesn't work out. If you add up the number of letters in his answer, they don't come to the number of years that by which his age was reduced. Unless you include the letters in Paro's question. When Paro said, how old are you? You've got to include those letters in. And why? That's not fair, Reb Chaim Shmuel Levitz. That he shouldn't have answered in such a way. Okay, he shouldn't have said, I'm not as old as I look, and my age didn't get as far as my father's, and I only look old because I've had a terrible time. Good, that wasn't the way he should have answered. But why is he punished for Paro asking the question? And Reb Chaim Shmuel Levitz answers, because it's his fault, it was Yaakov's fault that Paro asked the question. What did Paro ask? How old are you? Goodness me, you look so terribly old. And Yaakov answers, I'm not as old as I look, I've just had a tough life. Says Reb Chaim Shmuel Levitz, the fact that he looked so old, so as to prompt that question from Paro, that's the taina against him. Not only the answer, the question is also a taina. A person shouldn't look older than his age. He shouldn't look as if he's suffering all that much. One must be able to accept the compliments and enjoy the good things. Everything doesn't have to be a complaint and a bitterness. One must be able to say, I'm fortunate, Baruch Hashem, and so it is. And Chaim Shmulevitz used to often talk about that, how it's a Kiddush Hashem. When a Ben Torah is complimented, that's a Kiddush Hashem. If a Ben Torah is fortunate enough to have wealth, or to have good health, or to have good looks, or any talent, that's an opportunity for Kiddush Hashem. That's an opportunity to be able to say, yes, Taka, that's how it is. There's enough Nebuchim that where one has of the opposite, where people complain, if he's such a tzaddik, why is he so poor? If he's such a tzaddik, why is he suffering? When it happens sometimes that a tzaddik is well off, that's something which has to be glorified, not something which has to be diminished. How do you glorify it without coming to gaiva, without coming to arrogance and self-centeredness? The acknowledgement of the source, that's all. It's not mine. Yes, I've got it, but it's not mine. It's like coming to a bank manager and saying, you know, you're so much money you've got in this place. The safe is full and all the investments that you've got, whew, what an important man you are. He's able to say, yes, I'm important to have been appointed to the position of managing all that money. I wish it was mine, but it's not. It's my clients. There's no arrogance in that. He's understanding the more money he's got in the bank, the more the achrayus, the more the responsibility. It doesn't bloat him in any way. And so it is with each of our assets. If we see the assets with which the Ribbono Shel Olam has blessed us as not our own, but as something which has been entrusted to us to use to the best utilization to sanctify the name of the Ribbono Shel Olam, then acknowledging the existence of those gifts and talents in no way impinges on the middah of anor, on the middah of modesty. And so when Moshe says that the Ribbono Shel Olam announced that he was going to sanctify the Mishkan with one of his close acquaintances, says Moshe, I know it's either you or me, he says to Aaron. The acknowledgement of his own stature, the acknowledgement of his closeness with Ribbono Shel Olam is an acknowledgement of a fact which he understands objectively and which doesn't bloat his ego because he doesn't see it as himself, he doesn't see it as something which he's achieved. This is a gift from the Ribbono Shel Olam, and that's the fact, that's how it is. The moment one's able to see it, not as one's own, but as a gift, then one is able to acknowledge it freely without feeling that one is in any way becoming immodest or arrogant. Now that's all very well for gifts and talents, but what about achievements? What about the person who wasn't born the great pianist, who doesn't have a natural talent, but it's just through hard work and slogging for years and years and years, practicing the scales for hours every day and moving on and on, just hours and hours and hours of painstaking work and toil, this person finally reaches the heights of the top of the piano playing world. And now once again you come after the concert and you say, the way you played that was magnificent, I don't think there's anybody in the world who could play like that. Now what does he say? Yes, but it was a gift from God. It wasn't a gift from God. I didn't have the gift, I did it myself. So what does he do now? Does he pretend he doesn't have that talent? Does he say, yes I do, it was very hard work to get there? How does he acknowledge that compliment in a way which still leaves him with an understanding that it's not himself? And this brings us on to the Medrash that I quoted this morning, where the Medrash brings the case of a king who gave his son to a person to bring up, a tutor to raise. And this tutor despised the child, and all he wanted to do was wring the child's neck. But he said, so if I do just that, my neck will be wrung soon afterwards. I will simply keep his wetness away from him, and he'll die of starvation. I won't have buried him. That way we'll be rid of him. Kach Omar Achaz, so said King Achaz, Im ein gedim, ein tiyoshi. If there are no little goats, there are no big goats. Im ein tiyoshi, ein tzoin. If there are no big goats, there's no flock. Im ein tzoin, ein roya. If there's no flock, there is no shepherd. Im ein roya, ein oilam. If there are no shepherds, there's no world. Kach Omar Achaz, in the same way said Achaz. Im ein ktanim, ein talmidim. If there are no children, there are no talmidim. There are no disciples. Im ein talmidim, ein chachomim. If there are no disciples, there are no teachers, there are no chachomim. Im ein chachomim, ein teirah. If there's no chachomim, there's no teirah. Im ein teirah, ein bose knesius of us medrashos. If there's no teirah, there'll be no shuls, no yeshivas, no institutions, no bose medrash. Im ein bose knesius of us medrash. If there are no shuls and bose medrash, ein HaKadosh Baruch Hu mashrash chinoso ba'ilom. Then Hashem won't apply his presence to the world. May also, what did Achaz do? Omad benoah b'seknesis v'mesbasa medrosha. So he realized the key to the whole society were the shuls. So he locked the shuls and the basa medrash and denied anybody access to them, and he figured that way Torah would die a quiet death and he can't even be held directly responsible for it. He's not stopping anybody learning, he's just closing the institutions. The important part of this medrash is an incredible discovery on the part of Achaz, which is actually very simple when you think of it, but people don't think of it. And that is, we create things and then we think that our creation needs us and that makes us feel good. But the truth is the opposite. We create things because we need the things we create, not the other way around. I'll give you a simple example. A man spends his life building up a business empire. And he starts off and he builds and he constructs in one company and another company and another company, and it builds and builds. He's got this enormous empire. And he feels good because he believes this empire needs him. He built it, it's his, and he guides it and he directs it and he looks at its progress and he feels responsible for its development and its progress. Comes a time where he's getting fed up, he's already a man well into his 60s, there are a lot of things he still wants to do with his life, so he puts in other people to take his place and he retires. What happens? If he's right that his business needs him, then what should happen is the business should die and he should thrive. But the opposite happens. Very often the business thrives and he dies. What does that show? He needs the business, not the business needs him. The business can manage without him. There are other people. He's not indispensable in the business. But the business has become indispensable to him. We need the things that we create. We are nourished by the things we create. It's an ongoing relationship. It's not that we create something and then we lock it in the cupboard and it's finished. We're nourished by it, on and on and on. Artists don't enjoy selling their paintings. They like to keep their paintings. They have an ongoing relationship with their paintings. It's not that once they've painted, it's finished, now look, I've done it and I can get on to something else. That's his creation. He doesn't like to see it alienated into somebody else's hands. He does it reluctantly, unless he's a businessman. If he's a businessman and his art is only a means of business, then he enjoys selling them, because the height, the pinnacle of his achievement is getting a high price for his payment. The pinnacle is not producing the work of art. But if he's truly an artist rather than a businessman, and his fulfillment, his life is the production of the paintings, is the creation of his artistic expression, then he doesn't want to get rid of his painting. He has a continuing relationship. Each time, each day he comes and he looks at his painting, he sees something, he gets something from his painting. His painting doesn't get anything from him. His painting can live fine without him and will live fine without him. Look at all the beautiful sculptures in Florence living long after Michelangelo. Could Michelangelo have lived without the sculptures? What would have happened if one fine day somebody would have come and destroyed everything that Michelangelo had created? Every painting and every sculpture. What would have happened to Michelangelo? Would he have been the same person afterwards? Would he have been able to survive such a knock? He wouldn't have. But he's disappeared hundreds of years ago, and the sculptures and paintings are still doing relatively fine. What does that mean? Our creations don't need us. We need our creations. That's what Achaz realizes. Look what Achaz says here. It's the wrong way around the way Achaz puts it, but it's so beautiful. He says, if there are no little goats, there are no bigger goats. The little goats produce the bigger goats. Fine. If there are no bigger goats, there's no flock. A flock is produced by many of the big goats. If there's no flock, there's no shepherd. Is the shepherd produced by the flock? No, not really. The shepherd comes independently. The shepherd is produced by the need created by the flock. If there's a flock, there's a need for a shepherd. If there's a need, there'll be a shepherd. We create needs, and once the need is fulfilled, the need is then fulfilled, that's the creation. But the need has to be created first. And the need continues. When the flock needs the shepherd, that's not a one-off need. The flock creates the need for the shepherd. If there is no flock, there is no need. Now that there is a flock, there's a need. So we've got to provide a shepherd. And does that mean we can provide the shepherd and then take the shepherd away? No. At no stage can we take the shepherd away. So the flock continues to need that shepherd. So although it's the flock who's created the shepherd, it's the flock who needs the shepherd. It's not the shepherd who needs the flock. Just like Michelangelo in the painting. He creates the painting, but it's he who needs the painting. It's not the painting who needs him. That's where we differ from the Ribbono Shel Olam in our creation. Rebbeinu Shlom creates not because he needs. We create because we need. We need that which we create. Not only do we need the act of creation, but we need our creations. We need to continue with them. And then Achaz applies it to the human situation. And he says, "Imen ktanim, imen talmidim. If there are no little ones, there are no talmidim. Imen talmidim, imen chachomim. If there are no talmidim, there are no chachomim." And he doesn't mean evolutionary, from an evolutionary point of view, that the little ones become big ones and the big ones become talmidim. That's not what he means. Because the goats don't become shepherds. They don't graduate. No matter how long you keep a goat in goat school, he doesn't become a shepherd. And so there are many people, no matter how long they'll sit in yeshiva, they'll never become Rosh Yeshivas. It's not an automatic evolution. But the existence of the Talmidim creates the need for Chachomim. If there are Talmidim there, they will need Chachomim. And the greater the Talmidim, the greater the Chochem they will need. And so they develop that need. And the need then has to be provided, but it's an ongoing need. And so it goes on until the Bosa Knesset of Bosa Medrash. Why do we build institutions? Why do we build shuls? Why do we build yeshivas? Why do we build Bosa Medrash? Big Bosa Medrash? Because we need them. And having built them, we continue to need them. Says Achaz, so if I want to destroy it all, what must I take away? In order to undermine the whole structure, must I pull out the foundation? No, I don't have to pull out the foundation. I can pull off the top of the pyramid. Because the nourishment comes from the top, not from the bottom. Who created the... What is the need for the institutions? Torah. He says, if there's no Torah, there will be no shuls and no Bosa Medrash. So Torah creates the need for the institutions. And then that need continues. So if I remove the institutions, Torah will diminish. Once Torah is diminished, the Chachomim will diminish, because the Chachomim need the Torah. Once the Chachomim diminish, the Talmidim will diminish, and so it goes all the way down. He understands that the nourishment comes from the creation. The creation feeds the Creator, not the Creator feeding the creation. In the Ribbono Shel Olam's case, and the ultimate Creator, it works the other way around. Hashem creates us, and He, the Creator, continues to feed us. It's not He who needs us, we need Him. But when we create, that's our difference. We create what we need, and we are nourished by what we create. It's not that our creations are nourished by us. That would be godly already. We would be the Ribbono Shel Olam if we nourished our creations. Once we've made our creations, they can stand independently of us. But we can't stand independently of them. We need them still. We need that continuity. And so it's important when a person taking our concept now to the next step, we ask, it's all very well when you're blessed with a talent and a gift, to acknowledge that the source of that talent and gift is the Ribbono Shel Olam, it's not me. But here we're talking about a situation where it's not a gift, it's something I've worked for, something I've created. So let's go back to the Michelangelo example. If somebody looks at the David that Michelangelo created and one says, "My dear friend Michelangelo, phew, you're a genius. You're an absolute genius. Look at that." He can answer, "Yes, you're right. Look at that. And you know that I'm dependent on it. It's greater than me. Because if you smash that, I'm dead. So I'm nothing special. That pestle, that idol standing there, that inanimate object, my life is dependent on it. That's how small and insignificant I am. But I can be dependent on a little object like that I made." One can acknowledge one's dependency on even one's own work, and thereby make oneself kemisha eino. So who am I after all? My work is great, thank you. There's nothing wrong with accepting that compliment. My work is great. But that doesn't mean I'm great. The greater my work is, the more I realize how insignificant I am. How the human being is able to create things that are so much bigger than him. He's able to create a level above him. That's Achaz's equation. The little ones can create big ones. The big ones create Chachomim. The Chachomim create Rosh Yeshivas. The Rosh Yeshivas create Torah. Torah creates institutions. That each generation, each item creates something much bigger than it, from which it nourishes itself thereafter. The acknowledgement that what I've created is bigger than me enabled me to feel kenisha enoi even when I've created something magnificent. I can acknowledge the magnificence of my achievements while at the same time acknowledging the insignificance of my ego, of myself. The fact that I need that creation shows how inadequate I really am, how unimportant I really am. And that's why I said at the beginning of the shiur that not only is modesty and personality development not contradictory, but they are in fact complementary. Because in order to develop self-esteem, and in order to develop character and personality, I need to be able to be proud of my achievements. But if I'm going to be proud of my achievements, I'm going to be bordering on gaiva, on arrogance. There we found the formula to be able to separate the achievement from the self. Not only to separate, but the greater the achievement, to be able to feel the inadequacy or the belittlement of the ego. Yes, the achievement is great. A human being is able to create things bigger than himself. And now I'm dependent on that which I created. So unimportant am I that I cannot live without it. And so if one goes to that same individual who built this empire, and one says, you're an amazing person. You started off without a penny. Just look what you've done. What's he meant to say? It's nothing? What do you mean it's nothing? It's a multi-million rand organization employing thousands of people, creating wealth for people, giving all sorts of charity all over the world. Why should he say it's nothing? It isn't nothing. So what's he meant to say? Yes, Baruch Hashem, I worked hard and I was able to create it. But you know what? I can't live without it. It doesn't make me a great person. I'm dependent on it. It's a crutch. I need it. I'm nourished by it. That's what's important. It's like a child in its relationship to the mother who's feeding it. It's all very well to say, and one has to see it as if, kibiyochel, so to say, the child creates the mother, in using Achaz's image, using Achaz's formula. And therefore to say to the child, look what a wonderful little creature you are. You created this magnificent mother. The child has to say, yes, wonderful. But take that mother away and I'm dead. So that, I'm nothing. The greatness is in the mother. And so each generation says, the Talmidim say of their Rabbein who they created. What kind of example can one give? A group of people get to themselves together and they form a shul. And they want a rov now. But they're an outstanding group of people. They're all Talmidei Chachomim themselves. They're all fine people. So you can imagine what kind of rov they're going to get. So they go looking and finally they find the rov. And they stimulate the rov and the rov grows with them. Who owns who? What is the source of nourishment? They could say, we employed the Rav, so we're nourishing him, we're paying him, after all. But that's not the correct relationship. It's true, we caused him into being. We brought him, we employed him. But we employed him in order that he should feed us. It's like a nation that appoints a government. It's all very well to say, it's my government. They work for me. They must do what I tell them. It doesn't really work like that, not even in a democracy. It's true it's my government. It's true I pay for them. It's true I employ them. But what have I employed them to do? To rule me, to govern me. That is their job. It's all very well for them to see themselves as servants of the nation. But the nation dare not see them as their servants. The nation has to see them as their government. It's part of the maturing process which is going to have to take place in this country one day. Where people are going to realize that even when they install a government truly democratically and they feel that they have participated as fully as is possible in installing that government, they're installing a government to rule them, not a government to be subservient to them. And so it is with each of these stages. The one underneath produces the layer on top, but he produces that layer to rule over him and to nourish him and to feed him. That's what he's doing. And provided you realize that your creation is the layer on top, and you are now below that which you've created. You've created something bigger than you, which is what we should be creating. There's no chav to create something smaller than you. That's not a creation. The whole idea of a chidush is to be mechadish, to come out with an idea, with a concept, with a thought, with an invention, with a development of an idea or anything. Surely it must be greater than you. And the moment you're able to emphasize the greatness of your creation and your dependency on it, then you're able to enjoy it without going over the boundary lines of arrogance. And then I said the third thing I was going to do was use that to answer a question which the Baalei Musar asked once again on Moshe Rabbeinu. After this whole business, Moshe says, "V'eisira chatos dorish dorash Moshe." Moshe sought out the goat which had been brought as a korban chatos, v'hinei seirot, and it had been burnt. V'yiktzef al Elozer v'alisoma b'nei Aaron and Esorim lemer, and he got angry with Elozer and Esoma. And then Aaron says to Moshe, "Hey, na yeh makriv es chatos on esaylosim lifnei Hashem v'tikrono esikoele." Don't you know I'm an oinen? We've just suffered this terrible loss. It isn't right. The halach is that shouldn't have been eaten. So we did the right thing, and my sons did the right thing. And Moshe listens to this argument. It's a halachic discourse. They're having a halachic debate. Moshe says, "Where is the seir? Why has it been completely burnt? There were parts of it that needed to be consumed." And Aaron disagrees and says, "No. In this case, there was no part of it that could be consumed. The only kohanim is our family, and our family has just suffered this loss, and we're not in a state where we're permitted to eat the korban." And says, "Vayishma Moshe vayitav beinav." Moshe said, "Yishakeach. I like that. Thank you. Says Rashi, Hoido v'loy bush, loy marloy shumati. He admitted, he said to Aaron, you're right, I was wrong, I forgot the halacha, I didn't remember the halacha clearly, you're right. And the Torah praises Moshe for not being embarrassed and saying, I never heard it before. Don't know where you get this from. Ask the Balin Musa, what kind of praise is this? What do we suspect that Moshe would tell a lie just to save face? He's embarrassed, like he's made a mistake. That's what's happened. Moshe has just made a halachic mistake. He comes in angrily, where is the seer? It's supposed to be here. He says, Aaron, excuse me. And he very politely points out to Moshe that the halacha is correct, but the goat should have been burnt. And it was burnt. Says the Torah, and you know what, this Moshe Rabbeinu is such a great man, he didn't even pretend that he never knew the halacha. He accepted, yes, you're right, I forgot the halacha. And the Balei Musa asked, what kind of praise is it that Moshe Rabbeinu didn't tell a lie? Like praising somebody, you know what, this man is such a tzaddik, he got angry with his wife last night because she burnt his steak and he didn't murder her, she's still alive, he could have murdered her and he didn't. And he could have even had an alibi, he could have gotten away with it, nobody would have even known, but he didn't. Such self-control, such a tzaddik. Isn't it incredible? Moshe Rabbeinu, what do we suspect? Moshe Rabbeinu is going to tell Sheker because he's embarrassed a little bit? They give various answers. But we need to understand the Yetzirah of different people. Even a Moshe Rabbeinu has a Yetzirah. Everybody has a Yetzirah. And kol ha-godol mechaveru yitzre godol himenu. The greater the person, the greater the Yetzirah. One never gets to a point where one has removed the Yetzirah. As long as one is alive, one battles the Yetzirah. But different people have Yetzirahs in different areas. And one can't compare. One can't say one doesn't understand that person's Yetzirah, because you've got to compare it to the area where you have a Yetzirah. Some people have a Yetzirah for money. Some people have a Yetzirah for sexual relationships. Some people have Yetzirah for all sorts of different things. I remember there was a very frum man who was a gabber in a shul, in a very frum shul overseas in Europe, and he was one of the most respected balabatim in that community. And he told me, I don't know why he told me one day, he says, there's one Yetzirah he can't overcome. I said, what is it? He says, on Shabbos, when they don't have goyim around there, they don't have servants, he certainly wasn't going to let any of his neighbors into the secret. He says, on Shabbos, when there's a really special international soccer game on television, he turns on the television. On Shabbos. Frum person, all his children are in yeshiva. He's a frum person, learns every day, goes to shul every day, govern. He doesn't know what to do. He cannot overcome that Yetzirah. And I could never understand it. I can understand Yetzirah. Like, it's been Mechalas Shabbos, okay. Depends for what. But for a soccer game on television, I couldn't understand it. And then I learned, one can't question these things. Who can understand different people's levels of Yetzirah? To him, that was the biggest Yetzirah. Other things weren't a Yetzirah to him. That was a Yetzirah. So there are different levels of Yetzirah, there are different areas of Yetzirah. What can we imagine? What is Moshe Rabbeinu's Yetzirah? What kind of Yetzirah did Moshe Rabbeinu have? To tell lies? No. To steal? No. What kind of Yetzirah could Moshe Rabbeinu possibly have had? Sorry? Imagine a situation where a man has worked again all his life and he's made a lot of money. He's now a multi-millionaire. And then he loses his money. He invests it in a business venture, the business venture fails, and he's lost all his money. And you come to him and you ask him for a donation for a charitable cause, and he's got to say, I can't give you. And he has two options. He can say, I can't give you because I've never had money. Or you can say, yeah, I used to be a rich man, I'm not anymore. That's no big Yetzirah to tell a lie. Why should you tell a lie? I would have loved to have given you some money, and had you come a couple of months ago, I could have. I was a wealthy man then, but I've lost my money. Fine. To admit to the loss of one's fortunes, fine, there's nothing wrong with that. But what happens if the man is a bank manager? If the man owns a bank and the money that he's managing is not his own. Also millions and millions, but it's not his money. And he loses his client's money. And you then come to him and say, you know, the assets of your bank, is there then a Yetzirah to say, well, it's or you say, your bank's so small, I thought it was much bigger. What would he then say? No, it's not that big, it's small. You're right, it's small. Or is he going to say, it used to be bigger, I just lost it all? He's not going to say that. That's going to be a Yetzirah for him to tell a lie. If it's his own money, there's no Yetzirah to tell a lie. I used to have money and I made a bad business decision, I lost it. But if it's somebody else's money, and my job was to look after their money, and I made a mistake and I lost their money for them, if I can get away not admitting to that, I would rather get away not admitting to that. If one sees one's wisdom as one's own, there's nothing wrong in saying, I forgot something. I worked very hard to know what I know, but you know, if a person's only human, I forgot. Can be. But if I regard my wisdom as a gift of the Ribbono Shel Olam, not even a gift, it's a loan from the Ribbono Shel Olam. He's given me my koiches in order to develop things, to do things, to be Mekadesh Hashem with. It's on trust. For me to say, I've forgotten. Hashem gave me knowledge and I've been negligent. It's gone. I don't know where it is. For that is a Yetzer Hara. To be able to deny that to oneself. It's not a question of telling a lie to Aaron. To deny with oneself, to be able to face that Hashem gave me something in trust and I haven't got it anymore. It's gone. I was careless. That's not something one wants to acknowledge. And so this Yetzer Hara is tied to Moshe's humility, in fact. Moshe's humility is that which enables him to separate himself from his gifts and his achievements. And to realize that his achievements are really not his own, but they're entrustments from Hashem. Once it's an entrustment from Hashem, it's much harder to acknowledge carelessness with the entrustment than to acknowledge carelessness with one's own. If it's your own, you can do what you want with it. So you want to be careless, fine, that's your business, you lost it, you'll suffer the consequences. But there's no excuse to be careless with something that isn't yours. And if you see your own wisdom and your own knowledge as not your own, how can you live with the knowledge that you've been careless with it, that you once knew and you've forgotten? How can one live with it? That's an incredible Yetzer Hara, even for a Moshe Rabbeinu. Or shall we say specifically for a Moshe Rabbeinu. Because he saw his knowledge not as his own achievement, because he saw his knowledge as an entrustment from the Ribbono Shel Olam, the acknowledgement that he'd lost a small part of it was something that was terribly hard. And he acknowledged it and he said Yishakeach to Aaron, he appreciated Aaron's words. That was an incredible greatness for him to be able to say, I have been careless, I got angry, and my anger caused me to lose something which had been entrusted to me. And so what do we find? That, as we said in the outset, what appears to be a contradiction is not a contradiction at all. Modesty and development of stature and personality do go hand in hand, because modesty does not mean the denial of objective achievement. Modesty does not mean a denial of gifts of the Ribbono Shel Olam. Modesty means, on the contrary, an acknowledgement of them, but an acknowledgement of them as gifts, not as achievements of oneself. And what about when one has achieved, we ask, when it is one's own achievement? Then we said with the Gemara, with the Medrash, with Achaz, how we see that even our achievements show us how small we are, not how great we are. Because our achievements are greater than us. We are nourished and we are fed by our very achievements, and the recognition of that, that I am dependent, that I am being nourished by my achievements, makes me secondary, makes my ego secondary to my achievement. So once again, I can acknowledge the beauty and the greatness of my achievement without boosting my own ego. On the contrary, realizing my own dependence on that achievement, and therefore the insufficiency of my own ego. And I can find my pride and self-esteem in the greatness of my achievements rather than in the greatness of myself. And that's the important thing, is to be able to feel satisfied with an achievement, to be able to enjoy the fruits of an achievement without allowing it to inflate one's own ego. And with that, we answered the question of the Baalei Musar on Moshe. How is it that Moshe was even suspected, chas v'sholom, of wanting to tell a lie to save his face, and instead of saying that he'd forgotten the halacha, to pretend that he never knew the halacha? And we explained the difference between an achievement which is one's own, and when one sees an achievement as an entrustment of the Ribbono Shel Olam. Where something is one's own, one finds there's no problem in saying, sorry, I knew it once, I've forgotten, so what? But if it's an entrustment from somebody else, that's not something one's willing to say. If I come to you and I say, I want you to remember this number, please write it down somewhere and keep it for you, for me. It's the number of my secret bank account in Switzerland, and I will not know the number, nobody knows the number except you. And if something should happen to me, my children will know that they can come and get that from you. Please keep it. And after the 120 years, my children come to you and they say, we understand that you've got the secret number. You say, Taka, I used to have it. Sorry, don't remember it anymore. So these things happen. Can't remember everything, you know. Can't do that. Moshe Rabbeinu saw his knowledge as an entrustment from the Ribbono Shel Olam for future generations. And the acknowledgement that he'd lost even a small part of it was something horrific for him. And there was a tremendous Yetzer Hara for him to try and not acknowledge to himself that he'd lost it, but rather that he'd never had it. He overcame that Yetzer Hara and was prepared to confront the reality, to thank Aaron, Vayitov Beinov. It was good that Aaron was able to restore that halacha to his place And in the process, Moshe lost none of his stature. His modesty remained intact, his chokhmah remained intact, and so did his tzidkus.